My reason for coming here and talking to you about the system is that as much as you might think that the Coorong and the Lower Lakes and that are fixed because we've had a flow, that's not the case. It's actually a far more complex system than that, and it'll take many years to get back to what it once was. And in fact, it may not get back to what it once was, depending on how one allocates water within the rest of the system. My reason for being here was not so much about the book, but actually about telling you some of the key things which have changed in this system over the last, largely the last decade, and what that then means to that system, to its value as a wetland of international importance. The first thing to appreciate is that it is the last wetland, the Coorong and the Lower Lakes, the last wetlands within the Murray-Darling Basin. The Murray-Darling Basin occupies something like 1/7 of the country. It's 40% of Australia's primary production. It is regarded as the food bowl, but don't be confused about that because it's only 40%. And of that 40%, 80% of that's actually exported. So it's actually a much smaller proportion of the food that's actually produced here. And probably something like 3 million people are actually getting a living from using that asset in a number of ways. One of them, of course, is through taking water out for primary production and other purposes. Just to remind you that we sit at the very bottom of that large basin. I'm going to primarily talk about the Coorong, but it's actually the Lower Lakes and Coorong together that is the wetland of international importance. These are the two lakes. This is where the River Murray comes into the system here. And the Coorong is this long, narrow lagoon, about 110 kilometres, running from the Murray mouth southeast down towards Kingston. It is very picturesque. If you have an opportunity to go and fly over the area, do so. You get a much greater appreciation of the system as a whole. And as much as we might concentrate on the lagoon that runs down the length of this peninsula, it's actually very much there because this peninsula protects it, known as Young Husband Peninsula, protects it from the waves that pound the region there through the south coast and gives this Coorong system a protected water body. It was listed as an international wetland of importance for two things back in November 1985, so actually some 25 years ago, almost to the day I think it is. It was listed because of the diversity of wetlands that were supported here. The diversity of wetlands include above the barrages, you can just see in this picture here, the freshwater systems of the Lower Lakes. And then it comes to the Coorong region, which includes the Murray Mouth region, which is the so-called estuary for this river. And I'm always amazed at how we call this the estuary, because 99% of the time, when water is flowing out through the mouth, it's actually the estuarine salinity, somewhere between freshwater and marine, are actually sitting outside this system. This region through here is actually fresh. But as you move away from this Coorong region, the salinities actually increase. And they increase from something between freshwater and marine water near the mouth. And as you go further and further down this 110 kilometre long system, the salinity rises to be about 2 to 3 times saltier than seawater at the bottom end. Now there's a series of four lines here, and I'll try and illustrate to how you use them. This is up near the Murray mouth. This is actually distance from the Murray mouth. It's about a 90 kilometre thing for those who can't read the actual numbers here. There are four lines here which coincide with different times in the year. And it's important to appreciate that there is this salinity gradient, but it changes through the seasons. During spring, when water normally flows out through the mouth in substantial volumes, the salinities at the top end are close to zero. By the time you get down to the South Lagoon, which starts at around about 60 kilometres from the Murray mouth, the salinities are seawater and above, and it increases. And then as the season progresses, the flows diminish. They don't necessarily stop. The flows diminish, and the salinity then gradually increases over summer and into autumn because of evaporative losses that take away the water but leave the salt sitting in the water. And so this is typical, and I could have shown you a set of figures for the 1980s, the 1990s, you can even find figures in the 1960s. That is a very typical profile for the salinity regime to this region. It is what people would record as a reverse estuary. A typical estuary is seawater near the mouth, and then as you go upstream, it becomes fresher. This system goes the opposite way. It's fresher, lower salinities near the mouth, and then it increases. So that's one of the components there which adds to the diversity of wetlands with the freshwater systems of the Lower Lakes. But the other key ingredient here is that it's a really important place for water birds. It is internationally significant. because of the numbers of species that come there, but largely because it typically supports more than 20,000 water birds regularly every year, and for some 9 species, it's more than 1%, and in some cases, it's more like 30 to 40%, if not higher, of their total global population is using this system for part of the year. People might want to know what the sort of numbers were like at the time of nomination. At the time of nomination, number of species were actually listed as this was the number one place on numerical grounds within the country for those species. It includes a number of species which are migratory. They breed in the Northern Hemisphere, like sharp-tailed sandpiper, red-necked stint, and curlew sandpiper. And they leave those areas in August, September, and arrive September, October, on the southern shores of Australia, many of them coming and settling in to the Coorong region. 12,000-kilometre flight, and they do that twice a year, and there's some of these birds have done it for at least 10 years in a row. It shows you that these birds are actually real frequent flyers. There's a suite of other species that are also Australian-based ones, which it was also important for, pied oyster catchers, red-capped plovers and so forth. It just shows just how important this one wetland is across the country. And you'll notice the numbers of some of these exceed the 20,000 of all wetland birds on their own for just one species. Now, I don't expect many of you to actually know these birds, but these are some of the small waders, and these are the sites that I would have seen in this system, because I photographed them at that time in the 1980s. Large numbers of small sandpipers spread across 20 or 30 or 40 metres of shallow wetland along the length of the Coorong. These are birds like the red-necked stint, a little bit smaller than a sparrow, a red-capped plover, which is not a migratory one, also about that size, and then sharp-tailed and curlew sandpipers. Now, you know, if you're not a bird watcher, you don't have to worry about having to know these names. There's a common name for these species. Because they make little peeping calls when they're foraging, you can colloquially call them peeps. And there are large numbers of peeps within this system. But that might be the group of birds that gives this system its notoriety, but remember it's also very important as a summer and drought refuge for a whole lot of Australian water birds, like ducks, like grey teal, black swan, and then banded stilts and red-necked avocets are larger legged waders, which the system is also really important for. But that's not where it stops. There are other birds on top of this system as well. If the Coorong has some sort of cultural connection for Europeans, it probably comes from the story written by Colin Tierley called Storm Boy, which is about a pelican. And this is one of the few places in the country, I think there's only two known now, where pelicans breed annually. It has a permanent colony of pelicans breeding in the South Lagoon, and it still has those. But there are other fish-eating species, not just pelicans. The grebes are in large numbers in the system, and terns, fairy terns shown there, also in substantial numbers, and a whole range of other fish-eating species. Now, nearly all of these birds, whether they're waterfowl, whether they're fish-eating species, whether they're migratory waders, use this system only for part of the year. They use it primarily during late spring through summer and into autumn, and their numbers are diminished at other times in the year. Now, this makes a real challenge for managing these species because it means you've really got to look after the birds when they're using this system. At other times in the year, they're going to be using other systems. Why are they using this system? It is the critical drought refuge, summer refuge for most of the water birds that live within the southeast of South Australia and at times within the whole Murray-Darling Basin system. To get an appreciation now, we've got a change in the actual resource base in terms of salinities, and we've got a substantial number of water birds using it. What actually supports these birds are a whole range of different types of aquatic organisms. Some of those aquatic organisms live within the mudflats, and the numbers of species that live near the estuarine areas is much higher than it is when you get down to the saltier areas at the south end of the Coorong in the South Lagoon. So you might have 8 to 10 species, typically in the estuarine areas. By the time you get to the South Lagoon, there is just one species. Everybody looks at those sorts of figures and says, well, if that's the case, don't worry about the South Lagoon because the diversity is actually in the top end of the system. But our biodiversity is actually not just about where the species might be most abundant, the most species are. It's actually about the different combinations of species. And just because there's only one species down here, it's a little insect, a coronomid larva, they are still extremely productive. And as I'll show you, the South Lagoon is just as important for water birds as the estuarine areas where most of these invertebrates might be. Let me move on. I'll show you a couple of other figures here. This is the numbers of fish. The numbers of fish are also highly concentrated in terms of species at the top end, where the salinities are lower. And as the salinity increases, you drop down to having just one very salt-tolerant species, known as the smallmouth hardyhead, that is very abundant in the South Lagoon as well. And if we look then at the birds don't show the same response. This is the numbers of species of birds you find, not necessarily numbers. We've been dealing with numbers of species as well. But you'll notice, sure, there are a number of additional species at the estuarine areas. But even down at the south end of the system, where there might be one fish and one coronomid larva, there's still 20 or more species that are very abundant. They occur along the whole length of the system, and another 20 or so species that use the thing less frequently. And less frequently means they use them in most years, but just not all years. So you get an appreciation. The aquatic organisms are changing dramatically, but the birds aren't showing the same sorts of marked reductions with increases in salinity. To cut a long story short, the birds will actually feed on each of the different types of food. So to a large extent, the shorebirds will take polychaetes and so forth out of the mudflats in the estuary. When they get down to the South Lagoon, they feed on the coronomids. Waterfowl, I'll show you some images of the resources that some of those use. One aquatic plant, Rupia tuberosa, is the primary source of food for swans and some of the ducks that use this system. And of course, the piscivores, whether that's pelicans, whether that's terns, they'll use a range of fish at the top end, but by the time they get down to the southern end of the Coorong, they'll be hunting just the single species of fish. So again, appreciation, the birds are actually dampening the impact that the salt might have on aquatic organisms in terms of species richness. That might give you an idea of what this system's like. Now let's start talking about the changes. The changes probably actually commenced long before the building of the barrages, but it's actually an event that's well-defined. It actually took the politicians something like 60 years of lobbying from various people. In the 1880s, you can find records of people wanting those barrages put in place, primarily to stop the occasional incursions of marine water into the bottom end of the lakes, because that affected their ability to take water out to feedstock and to water crops and so forth. The barrages were actually put in the late 1930s, finished in 1940, and it basically formed a barrier for those times when no water flowed over the system. But for the vast majority of times, water continued to flow over the barrages and you still had the connectivity as far as fish and other things were concerned. The second major change has been increased extraction of water for human uses within the whole Murray-Darling Basin, which has then reduced environmental flows. Now, the environmental changes in environmental flows have been quite striking. You can find these on the Murray-Darling Basin Commission's documents. This is the quantity of water being taken out of this system over a period of about 80 or 90 years. You'll notice that the primary time when the quantity of water taken out increased dramatically was in the 1950s. There was another spurt in the 1970s, 80s and 90s, and it's perhaps surprising to think that we were still aiming to try and get more water out for human uses even over the last 10 years. The net result is that the quantity of water that you could probably divert without actually the whole system collapsing rapidly, the maximum, is probably around about 14,000 gigalitres. Very hard to put those figures in place, but you notice we're getting very, very close to that. And if you have an understanding of what you might call the river's hydrograph, this is the variation in the flows from one year to the next, you'd realise this is a pretty disastrous way of managing resources. You might also note that the two states that are the major consumers of water are actually New South Wales and Victoria. South Australia has a very relatively small share, so does Queensland. And that's not to say that that's where the solution for all of these things is not picking out particular states, it's about everyone within the system changing water use. Now, just to give you an idea, that's sort of about 14,000 gigalitres is the water that people would have liked to take out on an annual basis. If you actually look at the actual flows down this system through time, this shows that it starts at about 10,000, which is down here. And you'll notice here there are many years when it's less than 10,000 gigalitres actually as the quantity of water within this system. Yet we have a system that's been designed to try and take 14,000 gigalitres out of the system, or getting close to that. And there are some years when it's much, much higher, which is the sort of typical thing, the rare floods and so forth, the 1956 flood. I guess most of us were around then, but probably most of us actually can't remember what that flood was like. But the notion is, how did they overcome this problem? It's because they dammed and controlled the water in different reaches. And we saw something like 10 to 15, 20,000 gigalitres at any one time if the things are full, which enables those dry years to be topped up by flows being released from the storages. And that's been a very remarkable feat of engineering. But of course, it's not how the natural system has actually evolved and operated. So we have this happening. We've now taken that water out. What then are some of the consequences? There's another way of looking at this, and I think this is a much more informative way of looking at it, is to say, what are the flows that are actually reaching the Murray mouth, and how have they changed? Before we arrived and took water out of the system, water would have flown through the Murray mouth on 99% of the time, and just 1%, it had no flows going through it. You know, this notion that the lakes were marine sometime, you can see various blogs and that saying, oh, it was definitely marine, is a furphy. The lakes were basically fresh and fresh most of the time, and there were small periods of incursions of marine water into the system, which everyone seems to remember. And if you look through the historical records, they all occur in autumn, which is when the flows are lowest, is when you might expect some marine incursions. Now, that red line that runs across the top there is 12,000 gigalitres. That is the long-term average flows that would go through the Murray mouth without extraction. The actual lines that I've shown you here now is what would have happened. The dark blue line is what would have happened if we hadn't taken water out over the last 10 to 20 years. And you'll notice that, in fact, it's dropped down well below that. But you might notice that even during the 06, 07, 08 and 09 periods, there would still have been 1,000 to 2,000 gigalitres that would have flowed out through the Murray mouth during what was being regarded as one of our worst droughts. The reason no water flowed out, or very little water flowed out, is that we were still keeping and using some of that water. The net result is the little pale lines here are the actual quantities that actually went out. So the last time more than about 2 or 3,000 gigalitres went out was back in 2001, and for the last three to four years, virtually no water has gone out through the Murray mouth. What happens when no water flows through the Murray mouth? And what does that then do to, say, some of those assets, those birds? This is the sort of image you'll get and would have got until just recently. What happens when you have no flows going through the mouth and no intervention works going is that this rather high impact southern ocean picks up sand, lateral drift and so forth pushes that sand so that when you get storms and higher tides, it simply pushes this coarse marine sand in and fills up the mouth and fills up the channels and basically stops the tidal prism from etching this region. Now, the type of sand that comes in is an issue too. Coarse marine sands are not sands that actually polychaetes like. They actually like the fine sediments that come from river flows and also like the nutrients which come from that system. But what's, and that was not enough to argue the case to have this thing actually dredged and pumped and so forth. But the driver for this was this argument. This region supports tens of thousands of small migratory waders, for which Australia has international agreements. It has an agreement under the Ramsar Convention of International Wetlands, but it also has these migratory bird agreements with China, Korea, and Japan that says it will look after those habitats that are shared by birds that use both countries. Now, the small migratory waders, those so-called peeps, have short legs. And in this system and most other systems, they forage not on dry mud flats, even though the federal government's proposed program has as a key performance indicator for management of this, the area of exposed mud flats. What it should be is the area of mud flats covered by 1 or 2 centimetres of water. And they forage in that. Now, if you have no tidal prism, the water level doesn't fluctuate because the waters don't change as the tides move in and out. As the tides increase, water flows into this system and then water flows out. No tidal prism, and these birds, for the 3 to 4 months that they're here, are forced to forage on the same few metres wide mud flat around the edge where the water is still suitable for them. Under normal circumstances, the tidal prism changes the water level in this twice a day by half a metre. When the water level changes by half a metre, it actually exposes a whole lot of productive mudflats which these waders can then access. So simply by not maintaining an open mouth, you greatly and drastically change the quality of the habitat for those birds. The state government at the time was reluctant to do that. They eventually did dredge the Murray Mouth. I can tell you the statements that the Premier and others said at the time, that this was just a lifeline. Why is it a lifeline? It's a lifeline because all it does is maintain something for a period of time until the flows come back again. But it is an engineering solution to a symptom. It is not addressing the underlying cause. The underlying cause of a blocked mouth is a lack of an adequate environmental flow. I don't think any of them believed that they would be running this dredging program until now for something like 8 years. That 8-year program has probably just ceased for the first time in the last month or two, but there is no guarantee it will not be required in the next year or two and required to come back again. These dredges are quite dramatic. The actual quantity of sand being pumped out per annum is nearly 1 million cubic metres, and it's costing the Australian taxpayer around $5 million per annum. Has it actually meant that you've kept the migratory waders within this system? Well, it's very hard to actually determine these things, but if you measured access to habitats with food in them, you find that over the course of time, from 2001, the last time there was good flows, large numbers of small little polychaetes living in the sand. But by the time you get back to 2005-06, it's lower. But it's actually not deteriorated in the last couple of years while this dredging program's been going on. Always very difficult to convert the numbers of these things to how birds might forage to it. But if you looked at the bird numbers, sure, the bird numbers have changed dramatically since the 1980s. When something like, and the maximum number of something, 1960s, sorry, a quarter of a million birds used this estuarine area, this tidal component of the Coorong. By the 1980s, it's somewhere in the vicinity of, say, 25 to 35,000. And it's been somewhere between 5 and about 25,000 for the last 20 years. And there's no clear indication that for the last 8 to 9 years that there's been a major change in the numbers of these birds using the system. I think we're lucky, but we had a major intervention to enable that to be the case. Let me now, and so you're going to sense now that the flows are actually important for maintaining an open Murray Mouth. They're also important for a range of other components here. If you actually looked at the so-called Goolwa cockles, often called pippies, in my day they were used for fishing, probably in your day too, but now they're used as actual human food. Their numbers are plummeting and have been plummeting over the last few years. That then affects the people harvesting them, shown there. They still have a non-mechanical mechanism. You use your toes to dig them out of the sand. Rather pleasant and therapeutic. They're also fantastic birds that feed on them, like pied oyster catchers, photo by Paul Wainwright, just one of the characteristic images of the place. But Mulloway. Mulloway have two places in this state where we know they breed. They're known, they make funny grunting noises when they're breeding, I think. But the two places where they do that is over on the west coast, and one of the major places is actually just outside the Murray Mouth, and their populations have been crashing over recent years. The current flows might improve something here. Now that's that end of it. Let's now go down to the other end of the system. The Coorong is largely broken into two lagoons by a peninsula that juts out into the middle of the system about halfway along its length. It's known as Parker Point, and it runs across here, and it's only about 100 metres across, and in my youth I would have comfortably, you know, throw a stone or a cricket ball across there. I would struggle to do it now, but it's about 100 metres across. And essentially it separates these two systems out, even though they're connected. But the South Lagoon is that lagoon which is actually saltier than seawater throughout the year. It ranges from about 1 to 1.5 times saltier than seawater up to about 3 times saltier than seawater, and certainly did that for most of the last 4 decades when we have records of the last century. If we look at the salinities for this system over the last 10 years, and this is just a nice sequence, and don't worry if you can't read this, but this is 2001 to, as you go up this thing through to 2009, you'll notice that for the South Lagoon, which is just this part of this diagram, the right-hand side, the salinity is not just staying at the same levels, it's actually jumped up to something like 150 grams per litre, which is 4 to 5 times saltier than seawater, and at places up to 6 or 7 times saltier than seawater at times. Now, I mentioned a whole lot of animals that live within this system that could cope with salinities typically in this range, 2 to 3 times salt in seawater, but how well do they fare at this level? And how did this actually happen? How come suddenly we've shifted this system to a completely different range of salinities? Well, it's also to do with what happens at the Murray Mouth. And the Murray Mouth, under normal circumstances, has a flow of water going through it, and you can see that by the murkiness of the water. And if someone flew over today, that would be what you would see. Which means that there is fresh water sitting at the Murray Mouth. And the fresh water sits at the Murray Mouth because most flows continue through the spring and into January, February and March in most years before we took water out. Now, as summer comes on, as all of you will know, water evaporates off large bodies of water. And the Coorong is no different. It's a large body of water. Probably loses something like 50 gigalitres of water from it. If you have fresh water sitting at the top end of the system, as the water evaporates further down, it draws fresh water into the system. And it doesn't necessarily top it off perfectly, but it actually compensates for that system. You don't increase the salt levels, but you'll get a change in salinity. It'll gradually increase, but it'll increase within a normal cycle. Take away the flows that we've done for the last 5 years or so. Instead of fresh water sitting at the mouth, there is now salt water sitting at the mouth. As the water evaporates further down, it draws in marine water. That marine water carries 37,000 tonnes of salt per gigalitre. Little wonder the salinities in this system jump so dramatically when you stop providing flows of fresh water to this system. What's the consequences then for those animals? We talk about the little hardy-head fish, that salt-tolerant fish, the most salt-tolerant fish that I know of. Its abundances within this system. This is the numbers caught in a little 7-metre seine dragged 50 metres, dropped from around about 150 within the whole 50-kilometre lagoon that is the South Lagoon to virtually nothing by 2007, 2008, 2009. Too salty for the fish, they can tolerate salinities at about 3 to 4 times, but not 4, 5 or 6 times saltier than seawater. What's happened to the fish-eating birds within this part of the Coorong? Dropped dramatically. Fairy terns have largely left the system. Pelicans might still be there, but they actually fish outside the system. White-faced herons and common greenshanks, a migratory species, have largely vacated that system, and their abundances are much lower than what they were in the 1980s, just shown in the very first column there. Major changes. Let me take just one species, because I don't think the pelican is the icon species for this area. I think this one is. It's fairy terns. The total global population of fairy terns is about 4,500 to 5,000 individuals. Yeah, that's right. Less than most of the whales, apes and everything else that we're concerned about. They're largely found in Australia in two subpopulations, one of them in southeastern Australia and one of them in southwestern Australia. Within the southeastern Australian population, it's about 2,500, 600 individuals. Was the estimated number back in the 1980s and 90s, of which about 60% were in the Coorong. That's about 1,500. By the turn of the century, it was 700, and a decade later, it's now 350. These birds primarily breed, and at least breed successfully, in the South Lagoon. They no longer have fish anywhere near their safe breeding islands. Most of the birds that I know in this system are something in the vicinity of approaching 10 years of age. The oldest known bird is 14 to 15 years. We know they can breed when they're 2 years of age, but we know there's been no successful breeding for the last 4 years and very little successful breeding for the last decade. This is a species that will, I suspect, be one of those which is at real risk of regional extinction within less than a decade, unless one can find a way to enable these birds to breed successfully. What about the other organisms within that system? Coronomid larvae, the same sort of story. Abundance is fine, they could tolerate salinities, but also disappeared from this region 2008-2009. These are the food resources for those small migratory waders that use that southern end. Their numbers too have fluctuated. Redneck stints have dropped out, red-capped plovers have dropped out, curlew sandpipers have largely disappeared, sharp-tailed sandpipers perhaps haven't fared as badly. Slightly longer legs, they have better access into deeper water and might be able to get alternative prey. Always difficult to try and interpret numbers of birds because they respond not just to what's happening in the habitat that you might be interested in, but they're responding to regional changes in the quality of habitat. If this one's really bad, some of them might be able to find alternative habitats, sometimes they can't. But the notion here is that we would have to say we've failed to maintain suitable habitat for those species. What about the other key thing, Rupia tuberosa? Rupia tuberosa is a key plant in this system. For part of the year, it's actually dried on the ephemeral mudflats, the areas which are dry around the shorelines. It sprouts in autumn, goes through and breeds in spring. How's it performed in this system? It's an easy enough thing to do. It's like a little bit like checking your lawn and so forth. What we know about it is that it grows in water that is typically between 0.3 and 0.9 of a metre deep within the Coorong. Why doesn't it grow in shallower water? Because the wind shifts in the water levels from one day to the next are about a foot, about 0.3 of a metre, and an aquatic plant that's sitting in water one day and then out in the sun the next day does not survive. So they can't perform at less than 0.3 of a metre. And in 0.9 of a metre, the problem is as follows. Now, most of you might be looking at this and thinking, two glasses of water. They are two glasses of water. Which one is Adelaide's tap water? Now, most people would say the right, but in fact, it's the left. It's actually the clear one. The Coorong is actually very, very turbid. And as a consequence, light does not penetrate to the bottom to more than about 0.9 of a metre. And so this plant can't grow in deeper water. It's restricted there. It likes salinities, which are typically 1.5 to 3 times it reproduces by seeds and churions. But it needs to leave those seeds and churions every year to maintain itself. It's easy enough to measure. You just go around and core into the dirty water, pluck it up and say, how many of my little cores have got this plant? If we then look at what the changes are within this system, we can show that it has disappeared from the whole of the South Lagoon. A small population is actually established in the North Lagoon. And it's disappeared for a number of reasons. It's not actually high salinity. Actually, the water levels haven't been maintained because of no flow to the top end. And it now has a low propagule bank such that it will never be able to re-establish itself unless a further intervention's done, which is putting back propagules into this system. And all because we couldn't provide an adequate flow and maintain an adequate flow to the Murray mouth to maintain the health of that system over the last 5 or so years. What about the birds that feed on that? The birds that feed on that, grey teal, swans and that, have also largely disappeared from this system. Avocets as well, but these two feed on other things. And you notice, gee, there's one bird which has benefited from all our mismanagement of this system, banded stilts. And in fact, in 2009, there was over 200,000 banded stilts using the South Lagoon, which is something like 90%, if not more, of the total global population is in this one little wetland. Why have they done so well? They've done well because in 2005, the first brine shrimp appeared in this lagoon. Within 6 months, the whole lagoon was a brine shrimp soup, a bit like that. The people who lived in the region said the system smells different because these things wash to the shore and they rot and they smell different to plants rotting. In the old days, it was the rupia that rotted. And they did so well that for 1 year, and only 1 year, they actually bred and bred small numbers. Now, as far as I'm concerned, when I talk to a group of students, that little chick has got to be the cutest little thing around, doesn't it? It's like a little piece of soft cotton wool stuck on sticks, but they're delightful little birds. They did exceptionally well because they were one of the few species that could exploit that resource. So what's happened to this system then for the South Lagoon? Okay, in the last 5 to 6 years, you've changed the ecology of the system dramatically. You've lost the rupias, you've lost the coronomids, and you've lost the fish within that system, and it's been replaced by brine shrimps. And the notion here would be to support other birds, you'd probably have to go back to the rupia coronomid system there. But it's still a wetland of great importance, and I struggle. I mean, I probably was one of the people responsible saying, oh, the Coorong's dying, oh, the Coorong's dead. I was always concerned because it wasn't dead, it was just changed. And the dilemma is when you say something is dead or dying, and there's lots of people listening in, the attitude is that, well, why are we worrying about water for this system? It's dead and dying. It clearly is not dead and dying, and I can probably illustrate that with just a set of bar charts. Now, you don't need to read this detail. All you need to know is that if this wetland was still going to be an international wetland of importance based on numbers of birds, the actual bird numbers had to fall below this line where my finger is going, and you'll notice even in 2009 and even 2010, the numbers of birds using the system greatly exceeded that criterion. In fact, in 2008, 2009 and 2010, something around the 95% of all water birds using the ICON sites, those ICON sites we're going to look within the Murray-Darling Basin, 95% of all the birds were sitting in this rather dead and dying Lower Lakes and Coorong. Such is the importance of that system. So, why is it so hard to give environmental flows back to the system? Why is it so hard? You know, we've over-allocated it, but because we've over-allocated and we've put an economic value on it, it's too valuable. We also have a problem, as I actually don't think we actually really value the environment enough, and those two things work with two other things which make it very difficult to get a good solution. There's a problem here in terms of a problem of scale. How can someone 1,000 kilometres upstream look at this system and say, how can my water extraction cause that damage 1,000 kilometres away or more? Very hard for them to get ownership. The other one's a time lag. You can take the water out for a period of time, and probably the changes to this system are based on 20 or 30 or more years of over-extraction. There's a time lag between extraction and the impact. Very hard to make that there. It's also very hard to... keep on hitting the wrong one, I think. Also very hard to sell an image when you bring people here, the place has still got water in it. It's still idyllic. It still looks fantastic. It's still got water birds sitting around it. How can you be complaining that this system is different? Well, the real change is below the waterline, and that's the problem there. How might you then go about solving this issue? This is the dilemma for the South Lagoon, and it gives you the notion of what will happen in the next 6 months. The notion here is this is where the salinity level should sit normally, somewhere between 50 and 100 grams per litre, 1.5 to 2.5 times seawater. This is where the salinity is now. And if you're going to actually save this system and put back the hardyhead fish and the coronamids, you've got to drop that salinity to below that line. Now, you can do that a number of ways. You could actually provide flows. You could also potentially provide water from other sources. You could do nothing. It seems to be something which is quite comfortable with governments because our RAMS, our convention and our EPBC Act, there's no penalty to government to do nothing. The penalty is when you do something. So they can rest back and say, well, I'm not breaking the law, that's fine. But you could do nothing. You could do something by trying to dilute that and flush it out with environmental flows, or we can look at some engineering solutions. Pumping marine water in is what some people suggest you should do. I'm one of those proponents who says you should pump that high salty water out. Let's see if I hit the right one here. So these are little models. And the notion here is that, and I won't be able to show that to you because it's a very small image here, but there's a line which runs along here which shows the do nothing. The do nothing for this system shows the salinities in the South Lagoon fluctuate between about 150 and 200 grams per litre. If you then had a modest flow, or even a large flow, a modest flow, that's an average of 580 gigalitres per year, it doesn't drop it below that, even if you do that for 15 years. If you have a substantial flow, 2,900 on average, then you've got a chance of getting it down probably within about 5 or so years within that system. Now, I'm not a bird, but I often think like a bird. What's going to happen to me in 5 years' time if this system's not fixed? That's too long for me. It's too long for fairy terns. One of the things you might do then is you could do what some people suggest, pump in seawater over Young Husband Inlet into the South Lagoon. It's shown by this green line. And you'll notice here that it's only just getting to the upper limit of what you'd like to get the threshold to after some 10 years of pumping. But if you pump that highly salty water out, It's actually quite hard to do that one there, but this is not so hard. Within about 2 years, you can get the salinities back to a level that actually enables you to recover this system. It might cost $30 or $40 million to do it. $30 to $40 million, by the way, buys you about probably 30 gigalitres of environmental flow. What is the economic and sensible solution here? It's to pump the South Lagoon out. And if you did that, you've got a reasonable chance of getting both the fish and the coronids back, and you'd need to do additional work to get Rupia back into that system. I have just a couple of images to go and then I'm finished. The engineering solutions, these are engineering solutions. I want to remind you, just because you have to be environmentally sound managers as well. Engineering solutions address symptoms. Dredging the mouth addresses symptoms. Pumping out the South Lagoon, putting a regulator at Parker Point to control water levels for Rupia are all addressing symptoms. The long-term thing about what needs to be done is addressing the underlying cause, which is the loss of environmental flows. So whatever happens here, there must be some reinstatement of environmental flows if you want to have a healthy Coorong mimicking what it once was. And I guess the real hope is not so much in the guide to the Murray-Darling Basin plan, but it's actually in the plan. And that plan really has to be seriously thinking about what is actually needed for the environment if you wish to have a healthy Coorong and Lower Lakes. Bottom line, this wetland is still one of those fantastic assets in this state. There's no place that I know of where you get images like this on a fairly regular basis. And I'm going to close, probably inappropriately, with an image from Stavros Pippus, because this place has fantastic colour, not just fantastic birds. Thank you.